composer, and director of the Afro-Latin Orchestra. It all takes place on Friday, December 2nd at 7:30 p.m. Revolution Books is located at 437 Malcolm X Boulevard at 132nd Street. Take the 2 or 3 train to the 135th Street station. For more information, call 212-691-3345.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York. The time is 8 o'clock. Time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. So Billy Bones was the best to say the worst. I hope that's understood, but Billy Bones.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Manny Wilson here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Okay, you're not coming up, so let's try that again. Go ahead.
Good evening.
That's better. Kyle.
Hi, how's it going?
Bernie S. Somewhere. I'm sorry, say that again?
Greetings from Philadelphia.
There you are, okay. Yeah, everything is we're having a bit of a rain deluge here in Brooklyn, so that always makes things a little confusing. But here we are, another Wednesday night, and also we have a special guest tonight. Jason Scott joins us.
Well, hello, everybody.
From the Internet Archive, TexFiles.com. Any other projects you're in the middle of?
Variations of same.
Uh-huh, okay.
How about that?
That's good enough for us. We have a story that we're going to be featuring you on in just a couple of moments. But first, we're going to go over a few other things that have been happening. Actually, this is a story that we've gotten some attention on that actually it might be a little too late for us to talk about, but we're going to talk about it anyway. It's the SMDH Act. What does SMDH stand for?
Is it Slap My Damn Head? Or?
I think that's what it stands for.
I know
that's why Congress gave it that particular acronym. And according to this EFF release, the clock is ticking. If Congress doesn't act soon, the government will soon be able to use a search warrant to hack an untold number of computers located around the world. Well, apparently the clock has stopped ticking because as of today, they either did something or they didn't do something. Bernie, do you know which it is?
Apparently, from reports I've been reading in the news media, it has taken effect, or it will take, the rule will now take effect Thursday. That is tomorrow, and it's too late for our senators to slow this process down for more consideration. To the dismay of Senator Ron Wyden, our hero, and many other people.
From the fine state of Oregon?
Yes.
It's going to be a bad year for him, I think, and for a lot of us. But for all credit, though, this is not something that we can blame on Trump. This is something we can blame on, well, who? The Senate? Obama? Whose fault is this?
Oh, man.
Ourselves.
Yeah, I think firmly with us. Got to start with us. Somebody didn't pay attention. Somebody didn't get the word out, right?
Well, this is the first we're talking about it, isn't it?
Well, we're doing our part, yeah.
Well, not anymore.
It's too late.
Yeah, it happened today. Okay, well, let's at least talk about what this is. It's a rule change scheduled to go into effect tomorrow, December 1st. Despite the fact Congress has not yet weighed in or even held a single hearing. I don't understand how that's even possible. Now, according to the EFF, the fight will continue after December 1st, since Congress has the ability to roll back the rule change once it goes into effect. But it's crucial that Congress pass the SMDH Act as soon as possible, which they did not do, and delay the rule change and take the time to hold hearings about a change that would significantly open up the government's hacking authority. So okay, so they didn't do that. The rule change is going to go into effect, but am I reading this correctly in interpreting that the fight can continue after December 1st, or are they saying because they didn't do this, then all is lost?
Is there
Senate rules and congressional rules are extremely complicated, and probably could take several shows to go into that. But there may be a workaround to allow or to compel the Senate to make further consideration about this law. Basically, this law is an attempt by the Department of Justice to hack and perform electronic surveillance on a huge number of computers with a single search warrant, using the justification that evidence of criminality might pass through any one of those computers. And this is like deja vu for me. I don't know how many of our listeners remember back in the mid-90s or so, there was the Department of Justice, the FBI, was really pushing for permission to employ what's called roving wiretaps, mm-hmm. which back in the days where there were payphones that targets of interest may have been using payphones. Roving wiretaps basically eliminated the requirement to specify the phone number of the phones that were going to be wiretapped, and instead just said, well, just specify like a geographic area, like a particular neighborhood or entire city on the premise that the target investigation might possibly use any payphone in a particular neighborhood or city, even though tons of other people might have been using those payphones. And this seems a lot like that the government is asking for permission to actually install malware on a huge number of computers that might have been affected by malware, and perform electronic surveillance on those computers, even though the people using those computers may have had no connection no real connection to the investigation. And this really concerns me.
Yeah, it should concern everybody.
It sounds similar to the mass collection. The argument sounds similar to the mass collection of metadata that we recently went through, I think.
Wow. Well, you know, it's while you were talking, Bernie, I've been searching on Google News for any news about the SMDH Act. It's not a single story.
It's the first I heard of it.
That's all. The only thing that it points to is the EFF release. So it's really we all need to do a better job on this, I think, because things like this will slip in and we're all going to have to pay the price one way or another, whether it's less privacy or just having to fight all the time to get these things to be overturned. But there's more to come, I'm sure. If you missed this particular bad rule, there'll be more for us to fight against in the very near future, I'm sure.
We're just getting started, aren't we?
Yeah, just getting started. But, you know, we need more time. We need so much more time to talk about all the issues.
Emmanuel, can we give our listeners a practical example of how this particular new rule could affect
them? I would like to hear one myself, because that's what I'm searching for right now. Do you have that ability to tell us this?
My understanding of it is that if your computer has, you know, there's these things called botnets, which are basically sort of like denial of service. Most of our listeners heard of denial of service attacks, where there's a large number of computers that are used to send targeted email to a large number of other computers that could themselves be infected with malware to allow them to be used in more botnet attacks from large computers, if large numbers of computers. If your computer has been infected by malware as part of some botnet scheme, the Department of Justice should now, according to this new rule, be allowed to hack into your computer and look for evidence of where this malware attack may have come from, even though you yourself are not a target of the investigation. And who knows what else they might find on your computer if the Department of Justice can hack into it. I kind of think from past stories over the past several decades of FBI overreaching that once they got their foot in the door in your computer or your home or wherever else that you should have Fourth Amendment protections from, they're not going to stop looking at, you know, for, you know, specifically what they should be looking for. It's basically carte blanche. And, you know, a lot of computers around this country and around the world are infected with malware. It could have been a result of a botware or one of these large-scale attacks. Botnet attacks. And, you know, so this really removes what I think are Fourth Amendment protections from a huge number of people whose computers might be infected by botnet attacks.
I would love to see the actual definition of malware in this, because I'm wondering if TOR fits the definition as far as the people enforcing this would consider.
I just wanted to add to clarify, the botnet network would be a way of a scheme for pooling resources from computers that perhaps the owner doesn't actually have any knowledge of that, and that's both a bandwidth and processing power. And anyway, to the extent that they're being brought into an investigation, it isn't clear that they're. I mean, if they had no knowledge of the software and so on being exploited, that vulnerability being exploited, and then they then have to deal with the consequences of that, it sort of leapfrogs the developers of that software, who maybe made those mistakes, or other third parties that included things that made it susceptible. The liability doesn't really end up being with them. Here, the recourse is landing on the user who's innocently been brought into this botnet.
Right, right. Well, now, it's... Bernie, when you talk about the FBI can hack your computer, I don't know. It just seems like it's kind of what this mass media perception of our computers, our technology, that, you know, if you just want to hack something, you can hack it. It's just that simple. We've heard it with the election. The Russians supposedly hacked our system. And every time something goes wrong, somebody hacked it. And I'm just wondering, are we perhaps buying into that a little bit, saying the FBI can just, if they so desire, hack your computer and get all your private information? It's a little more complex than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not simple for the FBI to do that, but they use a variety of techniques, some of which are developed by other agencies, to basically implant malicious software on your computer to allow them to do electronic surveillance on everything that goes through it,
mm-hmm.
or is stored on it. And it just occurred to me a minute ago while we were talking about this. Here's a real world example. Anthony Weiner, whose computers were a target of investigation for part of some sort of
sexting scandal.
Sexting investigation was, in that case, this computer was seized. But the FBI found evidence of something completely related, and that was allegedly. Classified emails from Hillary Clinton's private email server, and that opened up a whole other can of worms. So, you know, the FBI is supposed to engage in what's called minimization, a method by which, if it's not related to the original investigation, they should ignore it. But if they see evidence of any other kind of criminal wrongdoing or what they think might be, then it opens a door for them. And, you know, there's so many federal statutes on the books. It's been estimated that general person commits 3 felonies a day based on what's in the federal criminal code. You know, I really am concerned about this carte blanche permission the Department of Justice now has for its law enforcement agencies to basically look in almost anybody's computer that's infected with malware and through a botnet. And that's, we're talking about millions and millions of people's computers.
And how do you get the malware out after they've lost interest in you?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. How do you? I mean, I would imagine that the FBI is cutting deals with antivirus software and anti-malware software producers. Like, all right, don't have it delete our government malware because it's part of national security or some other such nonsense. So, you know, I would not trust your typical antivirus software, anti-malware software, to detect government viruses, malware, worms, that sort of thing. I don't think we can be safe from it.
Well, now, speaking of of malware and bad things that get put onto various systems. You guys have been following the story out of San Francisco with
the transit system.
This is unbelievable. The San Francisco Muni system. Yeah, apparently had some ransomware injected into it one way or another. And I believe this meant that everybody could ride the Muni system for free. Is that an inaccurate statement?
That's what the press is saying.
Okay, but here's the other part of the whole story. Apparently the person who hacked their system was hacked themselves through answering questions to get his password from various sites correctly. Somebody was able to gain access to the email system that the person was using. And according to a source that spoke to Forbes magazine, this guy has been doing ransomware since August. I reset the password within three tries of the answer. It's a vigilante hacker, they're calling him. Contacted a security reporter, identified themselves as a security researcher. The quote here is that it appears our attacker has been using a number of tools which enabled the scanning of large portions of the Internet and several specific targets for vulnerabilities. San Francisco Muni was a departure for this extortionist who previously had targeted private companies. Targeting a public transport system is probably what got them hacked. The saga began the Friday after Thanksgiving when this guy broke into San Francisco Muni's computer system using ransomware, or injected ransomware onto it, held the rail system in a stranglehold over the weekend for a ransom of 100 Bitcoin, which comes out to about $73,000. Customers were allowed to ride the rails for free for as much of the weekend, a good part of the weekend, as ticketing kiosks were left inoperable, with screens at terminals reportedly reading, "You hacked, all data encrypted." I don't understand. I don't understand how they are completely crippled by this. Okay, your systems go down. What, you can't put people at the gates and just collect money that way? Is it really, are we so incredibly dependent on our systems that when they fail, and they always do fail at some point, we don't know how to recover, and it's just, it's like Mr. Robot, where everything goes bananas, and we have no control over the system anymore. They say the hack affected 30 gigabytes of customer and employee data across more than 2,000 computers, about 25% of the Muni's entire network. And ticket machines were again working on Sunday morning. Yeah, I just don't see why they can't go into local mode or something where they're not connected to the net, and they're just able to process ticket sales. And you don't put it on the network. Okay, you figure that out later, but at least your revenue stream isn't crippled in that time. And San Francisco Muni confirmed in a blog post it would not pay any ransom for the breach, especially after the guy got hacked himself. The SFMTA has never considered paying the ransom. We have an information technology team in place that can restore our systems. That is what they are doing. And FBI, Department of Homeland Security are also on the case. But that is the right approach, I think, to have backups so that you can go to the backups and restore things rather than pay some unknown entity when you don't even know that they're going to give you a code to unlock the software or your systems in the first place. Are we going to see more things like this, do you think?
Well, we see a lot of it already. I mean, the ransomware thing has really taken off like a rocket the last couple of years. I've seen it in a lot of companies that I've done work for. I've seen it in a lot of, I've heard of it from many others. And it's just something that happens to everyone. I know of a hospital that got hit with it and had to pay the ransom. I know of a police department that hit the news a while back that had to pay the ransom. They're the freaking cops.
Wow.
One thing that I think is maybe... I'm totally throwing this out there, but I think the prevalence of people of social media or Web 2.0 platforms needing revenue streams and using adware networks that are then exploited to get this stuff to people, because that is the human element in this, that people are on these systems, they're going out to the Internet, they're using various things, or other harder, more hardware-focused ways where they're bringing like a flash drive or other equipment, maybe through Wi-Fi and their handsets onto company networks and so on, and that hygiene is getting harder and harder as more and more of these platforms need a source of revenue to sort of survive in what we define as a tech economy now.
It does seem to be something that's affecting a lot of companies, a lot of people. I've heard horror stories myself. It doesn't seem like we're really. We can detect viruses and malware and expunge them from systems before they cause much damage. This seems to be something that the tools don't yet exist to say, hey, we want your files are suddenly being encrypted,
right?
And
right.
This could be something you don't want. You have situations like this. The thing that's kind of interesting, have you noticed that every time this happens, the demands always call for them to pay in Bitcoin.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, these poor libraries and hospitals and companies, the hardest part of all this is probably figuring out how to get onto Bitcoin in the first place so they can pay the ransom.
I've heard of cases where the ransomware people had basically product support where they would talk like, you know, someone's grandmother or somebody on getting the Bitcoin and putting in the information and everything they need to do to get their stuff back.
So they walk you through it. They walk through the process.
Training videos to set up your wallet.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, the chutzpah, that's what they got.
So you've been hacked. Please, watch our 5-minute.
Pretty much.
Okay. This is that's a serious story, too, especially if you do it to a hospital or a grandmother or something. That's not cool.
Yeah, ouch. Especially your local hospital.
Muni was kind of funny. Some other possible targets? Well, Donald Trump, certainly. That would be funny. Can you imagine if all of his computer systems, assets were... I'm sorry. I was miles away. I had a big grin on my face. But it could happen to anybody. Yes, it could happen to any entity, anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, we really have to be vigilant and be very careful, very deliberate in mm-hmm. what you're, where you're navigating on the web these days. It's wild as ever.
But this is a more serious story because this this involves a terrible crime and an injustice that follows even that. A Kentucky hacker who exposed the identities of high school football players who gang raped an unconscious 16-year-old girl and spread a video of the assault has pleaded guilty and is now facing a longer prison term than the rapists. Yeah, this is where we live now. Derek Lestutter pleaded guilty last week to one count of conspiracy and one count of making false statements to law enforcement agents for hacking into Ohio's Steubenville High School football fan website, Roll Red Roll, in 2012. The 29-year-old hacker, who is known online as KY Anonymous, has admitted to hacking into the site with another hacker, Noah McHugh, to upload a video to the fan site that showed evidence of the 2012 rape of an unconscious West Virginia 16-year-old girl by members of the football team. Lestutter and McHugh used the rapist's own videos to expose them. The Steubenville players, who referred to themselves as the rape crew, had dragged the unconscious girl from party to party, taking photos and videos of their actions that they eventually shared online. In the videos, the Steubenville football players joke about the rape. The 16-year-old victim said she drank from a red cup earlier in the evening and became so intoxicated that she couldn't stop the assault. And when the victim attempted to press charges, her character was attacked in the small town, according to Reuters. The crime gained national attention at the time, in part because the rapist inadvertently helped provide much of the evidence themselves through social media after the victim was unable to recall details of the crime. The video that Lestutter uploaded to the Steubenville fan website also included threats to disclose details that showed school faculty members and parents were involved in covering up the rape and demanded that those who were responsible come forward and apologize. Now, some members of the school administration were later found guilty of attempting to cover up the crime. A grand jury indicted 4 school officials over the scandal and for involvement in another rape of a 14-year-old girl in April of 2012. The school's technology director also later pled guilty to deleting files related to the rape. Conspiracy any? Yeah. Two of the rapists, Trent Mays and Malik Richmond, were found guilty of rape and kidnapping. They were sentenced to 2 years and 1 year, respectively, in a juvenile detention center and had already been released. Lestrada said the hack with McHugh was intended to bring attention to the August 2012 rape to harass and intimidate people and to gain notoriety and publicity for their online identity. I'm quoting now from the plea agreement that he had to sign. He's an alleged member of NightSec, which is an infamous hacker group, according to a publication or a website called HackRead. He has allegedly also taken an active part in the hacking of Hunter Moore, a revenge porn tycoon. A revenge porn tycoon. Yeah, okay. He's taken part in hacking that person. Wow. And also our friends at the Westboro Baptist Church hate group. They should be throwing a parade for this guy. So the hacker community has now turned their back on Lestutter, accusing him online of seeking fame through his hacking activities, which they say is the cardinal sin of hacktivism. I don't know what I'm reading here. This is allegedly a news story from a site called Inquisitor, but they state that like it's a fact. The hacker community has turned their back on. No, they haven't. Maybe some elements have, but this is a terrible turn of events that this guy is facing more prison time for revealing this than the people who actually committed the crime are. And this is something that needs to be talked about, needs to be spread around, needs to be shared.
Yeah, absolutely. The action, I think, is the result of it getting that information out there is, I mean, it doesn't even compare at all. And I think that should be taken into consideration, like the issues that are being revealed by this.
I don't care if he's trying to get fame for himself. I mean, he needs the fame if he's going to be sentenced to prison for revealing a crime in the first place. Then, let the fame come.
Is notoriety something he can really control? I mean, he can control what he does, but as far as around the issue. But if other people take note of it, that's not really, I think, in his wheelhouse. He can't really stop that or you know, and you can't really say that's his motive if he's clearly doing it to make another also very obvious statement that this is wrong.
Yeah, we've talked about whistleblowers and their importance a lot on this program, mm-hmm. and that's what we have here. We have the case of somebody who is blowing the whistle on something truly awful and now is burning for it.
Yes, Bernie.
Do we think that everybody guilty in this in this rape and the cover-up of it, this group rape, gang rape, and the cover-up of it, would have been held accountable were it not for this hacking attempt to, the successful hacking attempt to get this video and publish it online?
Yeah, from what I'm reading, absolutely not. It seems like revealing that information is what made the case actually go forward.
So, you know, obviously there was some damage to the victim in this offense, in this gang rape, in that, you know, videos of her being raped were circulated online, and that's horrific, not as quite as horrific as what happened to her, but, you know, this is really, this case brings up a lot of questions as to what is acceptable and what should people do to hold people accountable for horrific crimes. Clearly, the law enforcement authorities in that jurisdiction weren't doing their jobs, and the people at the high school were covering this stuff up. So, what was right here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not entirely clear on all the details as to how it was being disseminated before by the people in the school, and how it was being disseminated after this leak, but it seems pretty clear that were it not for the leak, the prosecution would not have gone forward. And for that, you have to basically acknowledge the person for helping justice be served and not further punish somebody for doing that. But, you know, it's I'm sure there are nuances to this that we're not getting from this story. But it just seems like a typical injustice to threaten the person that reveals the information as if they were the criminal when the crime is what they're revealing. I'm sure we'll have more to report on this because it's an ongoing story. But we have another story that we want to focus on, too, and that involves our special guest. I guess we'll just jump right to it. I can look at the story. The headline says the entire Internet will be archived in Canada to protect it from Trump. Well, okay, Jason, that's a good headline. I know you're...
I got a grocery cart full of hard disks right outside.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
Tarp on it.
They are getting internet. Wet. They're getting very wet.
Yeah, it just says internet. So as long as people act fast, you know, it won't get much more wetter.
Yeah,
it'll
and
be fine.
Please stay away from that, folks, if you're on Atlantic Avenue.
Ignore that.
Yeah, but... you're with Internet Archive, obviously, mm-hmm. and you're constantly archiving things. I'm always watching with fascination the things that you're saving. Can you give us an example of some of the things you saved, like just in the past year?
Oh, sure. So I work at the Internet Archive. My title is Free Range Archivist. I am not technically a spokesperson for the entire Internet Archive and all of its actions and all of its people, employees, and endeavors. So if I said something wrong, I made it up and I should be ignored. But the Internet Archive is well known for being the Wayback Machine, which is that place you go to look at what a website looked like over the years. And it's also a repository for scanned books, audio, movies, software, and a whole variety of other electronic data. And it's been doing this for 20 years as of this year. And there's a lot of material up there for my own personal things I've been involved in. This year, we grabbed a whole bunch of every elected official's site during the election cycle, trying to get a recording of their entire site because things change.
Okay.
We are currently in the process of archiving lots and lots of government data websites. I myself put up, it'll be 9,950 hip-hop mixtapes.
On a collection. I didn't know about this. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, there's these sites that provide hip-hop mixtapes, and you know, I mean, every once in a while, one of them is a particularly annoying repackaging of stuff that's out there, but a lot of them are like these giveaways mm-hmm. that are meant to kind of keep an interest in an artist in between their albums and concerts.
Right.
And when it started out, it was free in the 70s, obviously. It was something you handed out. Or sold cheaply out of your car to say, come this Saturday to this party in this park. So here's some tapes to listen to while you wait for me. And over the years, it kind of codified into a semi-professional and then professional thing where CDs would come out and go, here's my new mixtape. And it's them rapping over beats, or it's kind of like a DJ showing you their mixes. And these have been collected on and off over the past few years, and I started to get concerned because a lot of them were on torrents, and torrents die, and a lot of them were disparate and in weird places. And I said, okay, look, let's just see how many there are and put them up. And it's 9,900 so far, but there's 17,000 that I'm aware of, so it's taking me a while to find others. And I've done the same thing, by the way, for rave mixtapes, and I've done the same thing for just straight-up recorded folk mixtapes. You know, all these tapes and things that were kind of passed around that are extremely fragile. And so by making them electronic, making them available, and you have this nonprofit library, so if anyone's like, that tape is actually whatever, they send us a message, and we go, oops, sorry, you know, we put up 10,000 and then it goes away. But on the whole, these are always were meant to keep the artist's name in the news in some way, of like in between this professional, and it's of course, as you might expect, super the goalposts keep moving, and it's very weird because it's like Kanye will come out with a mixtape and then he'll come out with an album that's like $15 and then he'll come out with a mixtape, and figuring out which has always been weird, but it's actually happening. But then you have people who are they don't even have a contract and they're just trying to get their name out, and
right.
So they go there, and it's just it fascinated me. I don't like a lot of it. Like Sturgeon's Law falls into this as well.
It's probably good you don't, because you'd be spending all your time listening to it then.
Yeah, you know, the time consuming thing I've been involved in, I think since we last talked, was Over the Edge. Which was
Negative Land,
Don Joyce's piece. They have an archivist who has archived most of the shows. There's a few years that are lost and here and there.
Talk about Over the Edge at KPFA.
At KPFA,
our sister station in Berkeley.
And we have put up 675 full shows of Don Joyce's show going back forever, and he would describe them except for when he didn't. And so there's a bunch that are just the show and title and the day it was put up and nothing else. And so I have been listening to those shows and writing them in Don's voice. I signed them as me.
Yeah, we have a similar type of problem with Off the Hook sometimes.
Yeah, and what I've done, what I believe that something like the archive does, like you always have this problem of you'll have a fan site, and fans are amazing, and what they'll do is they'll grab, you know, 100 copies of something, anything from something that has technically owners to something that just happened, and they'll exhaustively note it. And then they'll die, they'll get a new interest, they'll have a conflict with the original creator, and it disappears. Because they're never technically the official place. And by having a nonprofit library like the Archive have a lot of these materials, I've been trying to encourage, okay, look, it's here. If someone has a problem with it, it is a problem with it existing. They'll come to us and talk to us. It won't be, I don't like this guy, or
right.
It's hosted on the wrong kind of site or whatever. It's us. It's a library. Neutral ground. And then I will reach out and say, does anyone want to help? So, for instance, I've been working very hard to put up every hacker conference video. Like, just going back, and people are like, what's a hacker conference in your definition? And my definition is, if they can put a drink on the podium and nobody complains. And that actually turns out to work pretty well. We just put up most of ShmooCon, and so some people are going in and describing, you know, the ShmooCon videos and so mm-hmm. on. And these large archives of material end up on the archive and are kind of treated as, okay, this is it. This is the big roundup. They're all torrentable because we put a torrent in for every item on the site, millions of torrents. We have it on this bandwidth, no ads, no weird adware. We don't remix them with ads. And then people can say, okay, here's the canonical copy, here's the description. And do that for, I have old, you know, in terms of this audience, one of the things I've really been big on is old manuals. So I've been getting my hands on thousands and thousands of manuals, and people have been giving those to me, and there's a whole project which would absolutely derail this whole conversation, but I have, you know, 75,000 paper manuals sitting inside of a abandoned coffee shop.
We have three boxes for you. We were going to bring them, and we totally forgot.
I think there's a copy of Lemmings in there too.
Yeah.
So
things like that, you know, things are lying around the office.
Yeah. And so people have been, you know, so at the archive, like I said, primarily people know us as the Wayback Machine, but there's also these literally millions of other cultural artifacts that have been put up there. And mm-hmm. I have a personal bent towards old software and old technological stuff. But someone will come to me with, you know, 100 old sewing patterns from the 1800s, and I'm like, let's put that up. So I try to be agnostic and just try to literally be the library that doesn't need to fade. Like you know, I mean, it's a terrible comparison, but, you know, like with Netflix, the reason stuff disappears isn't because they don't want it up there. It's because they negotiate with a group, and the group uh-huh. says, we give you a standard 2-year contract or a 1-year contract, and then it ends. And at the end, they look at the numbers, and they say, well, only 5 people looked at it last month.
Uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, who needs it? At the archive, we're like, somebody looked at it one time. You know, we don't really play that game, and so not being that based, we'll let the long tail go on for, you know, years and years and years. And to be honest, you know, like one of the ones I find really inspiring is there's like these really old electrical engineering books that are up there. And I've seen they've gotten 10,000 reads and more. And I'm like, that's some poor person's engineering degree. That's what got them on to that without having to, you know, they could pull it down, read it, and they don't have to be like, oh, man, where am I going to go to community college in between my 2 jobs?
Right.
You know, like somebody can actually start to get the, you know, because these things, these facts haven't changed. Like electricity still works the same way. If it's from the 20s, it's okay. Generally, ohms are still ohms.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about this material that Netflix in particular goes away because people aren't watching it. Have you encountered material that is simply locked away? And is some Norman Lear pieces come to mind, actually, from the 70s that have not been aired since then. They're in a warehouse someplace, I think in Chicago, and because nobody has the rights to them, nobody can see them. That bothers me because you have examples of artwork that, because of financial reasons, is eventually going to decay and never be seen again. How do you fight something like that? How do you preserve material that's locked in warehouses?
So on a greater conversation on that, it's a shame that so much of the culture of the world is a product. And that's just the shame.
Yes.
And so some parts of that are neat. That is to say, the packaging is nicer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But the fact is that things tend to have an owner, and an owner tends to have a voice, and there is no, well, let's take it out of town, or let's take it into town, to Manhattan, right? One of the things that's talked about is that there's a part of a housing issue, because it, in some cases it's easier for an oligarch to buy some property in Manhattan as a solid investment to, you know, let's assume they made it legitimately selling tuna cans.
Okay.
But, you know, this billionaire tuna can salesman has bought apartments and then just leaves them empty because it's an investment. And maybe one of his employees gets it as a gift, you know, to, like, hang out in. But there's no rule. So as a result, there's no if nobody's there, now that's property that's not being used and everybody else is suffering on that little island. And so there's an argument to say, well, maybe the rules should be different, and how do you do that, and whatever. But you're going to hit at the heart of what is real estate to do that. And the nature of art is that a lot of art is somebody's devised property such that they say, well, we made a show. Like, we all get that.
Mm-hmm.
We made a show, and the show is 60 minutes long, and it is this, you know, portrayal of this from beginning to end. Al Pacino is happy at the beginning and he's dead at the end, and
right.
This is a piece of work created by this company, and it is called that. That kind of solid product itself now ends up in this weird world where it's of meaning to people other than the owner. Like, if you buy a house and then you don't do anything with it,
mm-hmm.
your neighbors may get a little sad, and there's some laws for like that, but like, nobody goes like, oh, this national treasure of Emanuel's house. Oh, I used to see that when I was young, and now he's put a tarp over it, and I can't see it.
If it's a landmark, though, you can't do that.
Yeah, so you see, you do. That's what I mean. You then get into a point of, like, things get so up. But when you get to that point, like Tesla's old laboratory or something, like, you get into this weird position where, after a lot of effort and with a lot of effort, you'll look at them, and it'll be years-long, intense work,
mm-hmm.
these things will then be given a new life. You only ever see that with commercial properties, with a couple companies who have made that their bailiwick, for instance, Rhino or Criterion.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
what you're talking yes. about there is people who are so passionate, they're like, yeah, we will spend 7 years tracking down what hedge fund actually owns the defunct studio that made this and get them to sign off in a way that, you know, our professional negotiator can do that. And the problem is that the reason that they do that is because it can then become another product, not because it's freeing it. Like, you can't, we don't have a jubilee for art yet. Maybe we will at some point, but we don't. That'd be a neat thing to do, actually. Art jubilee. But so as a result, if you take away that, if you take away those products, there's a whole bunch of other material out there that I feel like people are trained to not give high shrift to,
mm-hmm.
Which is like I can listen to these mixtapes, or I can listen to a show that somebody put up, and that will fill my life richly. Like, I will not be missing out because I don't have my own personal copy of Walking Dead right now. Like, I can do fine, and I think that's a fundamental shift in perception.
I just wanted to add Shop Factory to your list because they're good too as far as releasing forgotten material.
There are companies who have made this their goal.
We need more, and I think maybe, you know, after a certain period of time, maybe artistic works can be declared national landmarks and where they have to be released.
Mm.
You know, with the basic cost to restore them or whatever, but it shouldn't be permitted to have something just decay someplace where nobody can
agree. And it's always very shocking to see, like, kind of how some materials just don't have any real home, and they are of meaning. There's so many things that are like zines and weird acoustic recordings that somebody did once and then never touched again, or I'm thinking of, like, there's these, like, you'll have all of these VHS-based things that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, where people were recording things and then handing them out, and they were selling them in like 10 stores, and there's only like 5 copies, and they were meant to like go everywhere. And if when you get your hands on them, you're like, wow, this is. I'm glad this lives again.
Well, there's also Bob Dylan recordings from over 50 years ago that were bootleg recordings. And after 50 years, apparently, they can be released freely unless the studio takes ownership of them. So the studio, apparently, is taking ownership of bootleg recordings and re-releasing them, but only re-releasing them to a few hundred people on vinyl in a foreign country. So they have control over it, but they're, in effect, strangling the possibility of this
sure.
work coming out, which I thought, yeah, it's really horrible to do that.
So bringing it back to where I think it's, I don't sound like a lunatic. You know, a lot of the stuff on the archive is stuff where this people have already chosen, like, I want my stuff to get out there, and I don't want to slap it on YouTube, or YouTube doesn't like it because I use a sample from Hawaii 5.0.
Oh, it's crazy, yes.
And so they want a place to put it. Like, for instance, there's a really good example, is the Kmart tapes. We had a guy who, in the night, okay, so the way Kmart did it for years was, you know, if for the people who've never been to a Kmart, which is short for a Kresgemart, they...
Whoa. What now?
Kresgemart.
Didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, Kresge. And you know what Caldoris stands for?
No.
Calvin and Doris.
Who's Calvin and Doris?
The happy couple who had the first store.
I knew Calvin and Hobbes. Didn't know Calvin and Doris.
Calvin and Doris had Caldor. So there's this heritage of Kmart putting up announcements over their speaker system, and they would have music to make you shop, and they would have announcements, and they were on tapes. And in the 90s, there was a guy who was working one, and they'd get a new tape every week, and he would take the old tape and he would keep it. So he had a couple dozen tapes. So he put them on YouTube. They start randomly matching their content ID system for weird things, and I'm like, come stay with us. And so we put them up, and we've had like millions of plays. Apparently, we are really hip with the vaporware crowd. Vaporwave?
Vaporwave. Yeah.
And I, this is when I became old. I've become old partially because 4 terrible gray hairs have appeared at the top of my head, but also because I looked up, because it was tagged with a vaporwave, and I said, oh, what is vaporwave? And I looked it up on Wikipedia, I think it was, and it said that it was descended from witch house and C-Punk, and I went, I know none of that. I am now dead. I am no longer a vibrant part of the stream of consciousness of human society. That's fine. But we put these things up, and millions of people have listened to these. And these, what I love is that when the news came out that these Kmart tapes were up there, there was older employees who said, oh, you know, I have the reel-to-reels from the 70s. Do you want those too? We were like, yes. So that's how I got to hear the Kmart theme.
I was just going to say, I was thinking as you were talking, I'm hearing that some of these things that people might not lock away, when we recontextualize them and other people say, like, hey, that's really cool, I'm glad we have that. Do you think that has an impact on the ones that are locked up, that people then maybe might reconsider? There is any power in that?
Like, it's funny, because you'll see these things where, I would say that there, if you, I'm stumbling backwards into an area I don't know very well, but the revival of Hong Kong action flicks, and then kind of like the re-engineering of that, that history, I think can partially be ascribed to efforts on the parts of several distributors and several real fans to make sure that they had play in this country, to the point that eventually places like the ones who discovered Kevin Smith, those guys, they were involved in a whole bunch of martial arts flicks playing in like certain smaller theaters and so on, and getting them. That's where you saw this culture that existed that was being pulled into the mainstream again, and now suddenly we see Kill Bill, and then suddenly we see, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon getting a full release here, and I think that you really do see that. So, culture is like a living creature. It needs to be, given a home and watered and treated well and given respect.
That makes me think of like RZA and Wu-Tang, because they were already sampling and licensing for the music, but they're big fans anyway. And
yeah.
You know,
I got to step in here, folks. This happens every time we talk to Jason.
I know.
We haven't even gotten to the story yet,
which is
why we brought you in here.
Well, here's the thing. So I think this is how it's critical to your
moving
your
the entire internet to Canada. What's going on? We have about 5 minutes to talk about this.
Oh, fantastic. So we're this organization, this nonprofit. We've been around since 1996. We have the Wayback Machine, and we have petabytes and petabytes of everything from old websites to music, audio, and everything else. And that's a lot of data. And it's always been an exciting engineering challenge to have, you know, we have something like 30 petabytes of data in total. And making that available, and every day is an adventure to make sure, like, you know, fixing hard drives. And, you know, we swap through a pallet of hard drives every month, you know, just keeping them up, just keeping them going. And that's some amazing people out there. Yo, Hank. Yo, Trevor. Yo, Tracy. Yo, you know, everybody. And these are people who are, like, you know, kicking butt. There's all day. And so one of the things is we have copies elsewhere of a lot of the data. We have one in Egypt. We have some stuff in Amsterdam.
No, don't tell people where it is.
It's okay.
All right.
But, you know, we have stuff around. But what happened was it was always – for an organization that always was on the edge of money loss. Like, we're always kind of, you know, we're a nonprofit. We're not one of those nonprofits that you look at it and you go, they took in $45 million worth of donations and they put 35 of it towards admin. We're not like that. So, I mean, we were doing between 12 and 15 million a year to cost, and we were bringing in 11 or 12. And you know, we have a whole bunch of things going on. So the idea of fully engineering a complete new data center with all of the content and everything else is a big financial burden.
Right.
So we were always, like, looking at different solutions. And then finally we said, okay, let's really revisit this now.
When was this, when you said that?
Let's go with this month.
Okay, so if I'm not mistaken, it's a certain event that happened at the beginning of this month that basically inspired this conversation to be renewed.
To be renewed, but, I mean, it was an ongoing conversation.
Right.
And I think that there's a narrative because the press does what the press does. So, first of all, they'll use the phrase, we're moving to Canada. And it sounds like this beautiful building that's out in San Francisco is going to be turned into a terrible dance club and be closed down at the end of the month, and we're going to be in 17 tractor trailers and we'll be over the border by sundown.
You're already getting offers to rent it out.
Exactly.
Okay.
If we move our stuff out and we go back because we forgot something, there'll be 19 startups in there. Don't worry. There'll be 19 startups selling you something that their mothers used to do for them. So we would be copying the data. So there'd be another full location in Canada. This was something that, you know, the boss, Brewster Kahle, thought would be a good thing to do, and he announced it as, like, the beginning of our next fundraising cycle, which is we always try to, like, not make every day a living hell of begging, right? I think that's really...
We're trying that here.
It's tough, because people don't know how much things cost,
mm-hmm.
you know? Like, they don't... There was a beautiful, if I ever find the link for it, I'll send it to you. But it's a professional BBC TV guy, and he's walking with you in what looks like a standard BBC thing, but he's explaining to you what everything is costing right now. He's like, I'm shooting right now. I just want you to know there's 5 people over here. We had to do this. We paid for this. This was here.
Wow.
This is what this is costing, even though it looks like it's just a guy walking around.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people don't understand, like, to keep something up that gets between 3 and 5 million people a day, you know, we're up in the top 200 websites, and you know, there's not many of those that both have no ads and B don't keep your IP address, and so you know, to keep that going costs them out. So we try to have a fundraising piece, and so one of them is we should really make another big duplicate. Let's do that, and that got kind of squelched into this weird narrative of, you know, the country's in a bit of turmoil, and people think this is for something or a reaction, and it's more a case of, no, that's something to think about. And mm-hmm. I think that your audience, the audience of yours that is technical, I would say the great thing about there's several ways to prepare. And you can prepare like a person who reasonably looks at things and says, I should make preparations. And then there's the person who says, every night I scare myself silly and I come up with 90,000 things that will attack me in the night, and I'm going to build a pillow fort against all of them.
Right. It's like the difference between the smart thing to do and the irrational thing to do.
Sure. Living your life as if you are a blind, scared deer is just not a great lifestyle choice. I'm going to get in on that. It's not a great lifestyle choice. But living like somebody who says, I live in a house, houses occasionally burn, maybe I should get a smoke alarm, and maybe I should come up with a method, not so bad. Should you be checking every smoke alarm every day? Also not recommended.
So you're saying the United States is like a burning house, and you wish to keep safety by moving things to Canada?
I think that the United States can be thought of as a place that has a lot of wonderful, beautiful things about it, and one of them has always been some measure of unpredictability.
Okay.
And that the nature of archives and libraries is that sometimes they get put in crosshairs or in the middle of conflicts that they don't really need to be in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, when a library is told to ban a book, that is often a parent who is afraid of things for their children or an organization that is afraid of their parents. And it's not about the book, and it's not about the kid, and I think that's important.
I hate to do this, but we're out of time.
I'm glad we were able to cover this very difficult subject deeply.
Well, tell us how people can help, how they can get involved, how they can learn more, everything that you possibly can think of.
Absolutely. So the Internet Archive is located in San Francisco, and there's archive.org. For some people, they know it as web.archive.org. There's archive.org/donate. We can tell you what we're doing and why we're about it. We also have a Canadian address for the Internet Archive of Canada, which is a separate organization.
That's always existed, right?
And that has existed since 2004, and they will take paper checks as donations for the moment, and they're a nonprofit as well. And it's all a real thing, and I am jason@textfiles.com or jscott@archive.org, and if this is the first time you're hearing about this, I'd love to hear from you.
Jason, we have to have you back because there's so much you do that is fascinating and vital.
It's about the hip-hop mixtapes. I understand.
We need 1,000 more of you. But, folks, please visit the Internet Archives, learn more about this project, and help out however you can. And that's it for us. Off the Hook this week. We'll be back again next week, hopefully. And you can write to us, oth@2600.com. See you next week. Good night.